Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Governor Charlie Baker couldn't hide his frustration today after the Massachusetts state legislature failed to meet their own deadline for agreeing on how to spend about $4 billion in COVID relief and surplus funds. Here he is talking to WBUR's Steve Brown.
We're one of the only states in the country that really hasn't gone about the process of putting those funds to work.
Now the Commonwealth has another $9 billion on the way from the newly signed bipartisan infrastructure bill. $9 billion in money for roads and bridges, along with broadband internet, electric vehicle charging stations, other priorities. It's a drop in the bucket compared to the total federal bill, which is $1 trillion, but it's still a lot of money. And with the legislature unable to spend money we already have and the big dig still driving through our collective memory, we wanted to find out what it takes to spend that kind of money responsibly. So we called former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, who agreed to help us think about it. Patrick is currently senior advisor at Bain Capital and was a candidate for president in the last election cycle. Governor Patrick, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you, Tiziana. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. And I want to ask you the same question. We'll get to infrastructure, and I think we'll have fun with it in a minute. But there's a lot going on. So in general, how are you, Governor?
You're kind to ask. We are blessed. Everybody's healthy and productive. And I'm aware, very aware, that not everybody can say that in these unusual times. So very blessed indeed. Thank you.
I'm glad to hear that. You know, it does make me think of, some people say it's a blessing, some people say it's a curse. May you live in interesting times. And you've governed in some interesting times. Do these rank kind of up there, Governor Patrick?
Well, you know, it's funny. In a way, things are always unpredictable at some level. You know, we are remarkably not just resilient, but creative, or can be, in circumstances like this. I hope that's what explains the delay in the legislature in voting on how to disperse the rescue funds, because we can be creative, and we ought to be. We ought not to just do things the same old way.
Well, since you went there, let's pick up on that. And I'm going to play a little bit more sound for you now from Governor Baker talking earlier today with WBUR Steve Brown.
We're one of the only states in the country that really hasn't gone about the process of putting those funds to work. Legislature made a commitment to get it done before they went home for the holiday season. And I can't tell you how frustrated I am, not just for me, but for all the mayors and the small businesses and the folks who are looking for an opportunity to do something other than what they were doing before and getting the skills that would be required to do that. Those are the folks I'm most worried about at this point.
So this hurry up versus think it through has been a tension all along on that spending package. And I think I felt like I heard a little bit of the tension in your voice about recognizing both of those needs. How do we get that right?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's a real choice. I think it's a false choice. You can think it through. There's been a lot of thinking of it through, and also move with urgency. Nobody's saying just, you know, take the dollars and throw them in the air and see where they land. Now, I will admit, Tiziana, that I have not followed the back and forth the way I once would have. I frankly don't know what the governor's priorities are on the dispersal of that of those relief funds, whether he has a plan that he's pushing, or whether he is just waiting to see what the legislature comes up with. But he is right to call attention to the fact that you know, there are families and local leaders and small businesses that are waiting to see whether the promises of the rescue plan actually touch them. And that's, to me, always the point, right? Policy for me has never been that interesting in the abstract. It's where it actually touches people that it matters to me. And I think that's frankly how most citizens feel about it.
So let's stay there. And excuse me, just for our listeners' sake, the governor put out his proposal back in the spring and this morning reiterated one of the areas he's feeling the most urgency on is money for housing, to help people with housing. Mm-hmm. So just to kind of file mm-hmm. that. So we are now talking about big, big buckets of dollars. And I want to move on to the $9 billion that's coming in from the infrastructure bill.
Right.
There are buckets that already say,
you know,
okay,
you're killing me, by the way, asking me what my thoughts would be on that kind of windfall.
Man, tell me.
It would have been something to have had that opportunity when I still had the chance to have a word in it.
So let's have fun with that. What would you have done during your administration? $9 billion comes your way. What would you have done?
Well, look, we have a physical infrastructure that is not consistent with the 21st century, and that that ranges from the T to the ways in which, you know, in parts of the Commonwealth, they might as well be, you know, what people might imagine Appalachia to be. They have no access at all to high speed internet, and the notion that internet anymore is just about being able to, you know, stream a movie or catch a game is, I think everybody understands, it's about education and health and safety and commerce. And it is a way of connecting to markets and to opportunities all around the world. It can be transformational, but it has to actually be delivered. We got in the President Obama's stimulus bill the money to be able to build the so-called middle mile, if that means anything to you, Tiziana. So the expansion of a trunk, if you will, for broadband out into the central and western part of the Commonwealth. And the supposition was that the private sector would take it from there, the way they did the same strategy back during the Tennessee Valley Authority when electricity was being expanded.
They'd take the last mile, basically, the private
right,
sector
exactly,
would.
Exactly. But the model of the broadband companies today is just radically different than it once was. So it's going to take a lot more public or combination of public and private funds to get that done. So that's the sort of thing that comes to my mind. And then the last thing I just say is just the importance of regional equity. You know, Boston is enormously important, in some ways the heartbeat of our commercial and social and certainly political lives in Massachusetts, but it's not the only place in Massachusetts. And central western Massachusetts, the South Coast, Merrimack Valley, I think have been waiting a long time for a fair investment, a comparatively fair investment in infrastructure. And I think we ought to be paying attention to that.
So
well,
I want to pick up on that. I was thinking this morning about the fact that in the city of Boston, they've allocated funding for an Office of Participatory Budgeting, which is a project where citizens have an actual say in budget allocation. So between, you know, the $9 billion in infrastructure, the roughly $4 billion in COVID relief and surplus money, you know, now we're looking at $13 billion. What could we do better to give people a voice in how that money gets allocated and ensuring it gets spent responsibly?
Well, you know, when we were proposing the last big infrastructure plan, infrastructure spend in the last couple of, we tried it twice, but in the last round, when I was in office, we spent a year developing a plan and doing that out of the State House, meaning with communities and in communities. And we made choices, a whole bunch of choices. We left some things that were, like-to-haves off the list and substituted in things that were must-haves, and they were very specific, and regional equity was central to it. So it's not like this work has never been done. It might be worth, you know, taking that plan and dusting it off and updating it, or doing a new one, but assuring that people have some. And I'll just give you an example. Every single governor, every single candidate for governor, I think for 30, maybe 40 years, has promised to complete the rail link between Boston, and the South Coast. Frankly, it could be one of the answers to the high cost of housing in and around Boston, and to the lack of higher paying jobs in the in and around the South Coast. Every single candidate has promised it. We made some progress on it. As far as I know, that progress has stalled out. Let's finish that. Connecting the east to the western part of the state by rail, or the western part of the state to New York, which is much more the sort of economic orientation in this part of the Commonwealth. We ought to be thinking about those kinds of transformative opportunities.
So I hear you on all that. And what I find myself thinking is we need some wins spiritually, financially, from an equity standpoint. We need some wins. And a lot of what you're just talking about are things that we started, South Coast Rail, for example, or, you know, middle mile and then last mile in internet mm-hmm. access, that then somewhere we weren't able to finish. Something got in the way. It stalled, or the private sector model changed. I wonder, you know, you say people care about how it affects them. Well, if $13 billion doesn't finish things, that affects people. So how do we ensure we get some wins here, Governor?
Well, for one thing is we could finish some of the things we started. I mentioned, too, that you just repeated. It's not like we have to start cold. And all I'm saying is that thinking on how to complete some of these projects can be updated, probably has been updated. They're new innovations. We can bring those in service of finishing those kinds of goals.
And I do want to note, I got an update from the team that phase one of South Coast Rail is supposed to bring service to communities by late 2023. So I want to shift gears a little bit in our remaining time. I mean, if we had all the time in the world, there are 100 things I'd like to talk to you about. But in our remaining time, I am mindful that you have deep personal experience with being a first as an elected official, as the first Black governor of the mm-hmm. Commonwealth. You endorsed Michelle Wu just before the election. She is now the first elected woman and person of color to hold the mayorship in Boston. I wonder, have you given her any advice? And if you haven't, what advice would you give her based on your own lived experience?
Well, she's so smart. The advice I give even smart office holders is surround yourself by people who are smarter than you, because you all lift each other, and ultimately you deliver better for people. I hope that you'll focus on being as much as possible out of the office and with people and listening, not just talking, not just sort of coming in behind the velvet rope to the podium and then leaving afterwards, but really trying to stay as close to regular people, everyday people as possible, because they tell you things. And it's much more, in my experience, than just, you know, you're doing a good job or a bad one on any given day. Their insights about how they live their lives, how people live their lives, Tiziana, which if you are listening for consensus points, actually makes the policy making better, right? Makes the executive work better. So there's a humility that and a presence that I think certainly I wish for in elected officials, and I tried to bring to my own work, which I think is meaningful in the long run, but in small ways it's hard always to demonstrate to others.
So I think my last question for you, I'm kind of asking you to talk to both our hearts and minds. We started this conversation with the interesting times that we're living in. And I'm thinking mm-hmm. of the fact we're headed into the holidays. Everybody was excited to leave 2020 to get to 21. And then, oh boy, 21. So as we head into a 22, what's filling your cup and giving you hope this holiday season? And are you optimistic for 2022?
First of all, I don't lose sight of the fact that 2021 was better than 2020. And, we are in contact with more, I mean, physical contact with more of our family and friends. We're going to actually travel down to Atlanta for, which has been a family tradition for decades, to have Thanksgiving with my wife's sister. And that part of the family, we always look forward to that, and we have been able to do that for the last little while. More and more people. What did I hear today? That when Joe Biden came to office, 2 million people were vaccinated. Over 200 million people are vaccinated now. It's not like we've been standing still. We haven't reached the promised land, but there is, my grandson's back in school every day. We are getting there. And, while I am frustrated, in fact, even worried about the disinformation and misinformation and how much of that is intended to drive division, I still believe in the fundamental grace of people. And I think that we have to expect and ask our leaders to model that, to summon that, and make that a sort of a threshold thing before we get to, some policy debates or cultural differences or whatever it is.
That is former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. Governor Patrick, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Tiziana. Be well.
Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving to you, too. It did not take long for Boston Mayor Michelle Wu to get to work on one of her key campaign promises.
Yesterday, during my first full day as mayor, I filed an appropriation order with the Boston City Council to allocate $8 million in federal funding to expand our Fare Free Bus program.
That appropriation would fund free fares for 2 years on three bus lines, the 23, the 28, and the 29. They serve parts of Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, and Jamaica Plain, all places Wu says have been disproportionately affected by the pandemic.
More than 59% of riders on these three bus lines are low income. More than 96% of these bus lines commuters are people of color. So by taking this action, we truly will connect our communities and supercharge our recovery.
We have been having policy discussions about free tea literally for years now on this show, since Wu first floated the idea in 2019. Today, we want to talk about how free bus fare would affect real lives and delve into the question of how that impact compares with the cost. And we invite you to join this conversation. Do you ride one of those buses, the 23, the 28, the 29? What would free fares mean for you? Would you start riding one of those buses if it were free, if you don't now? Or maybe a bus in your city or town if they did the same thing? I'm thinking Lawrence, for example, has had a pilot for a while now. Wu needs $8 million for the initiative. Are you okay with that spending? Share your thoughts. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. We're going to start this discussion with Mella Bush-Miles, Director of Transit-Oriented Development and the T-Riders Union at Alternatives for Environment and Community. Mella, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. Good afternoon.
So, Mella, I just want to start by getting your reactions to Mayor Wu's announcement.
I'm excited.
Why?
We've been discussing fare free transit for a number of years in forums that were conducted around sustainability, and like at the Boston Green Fest, for example, we did Transportation Tomorrow Today, and that was one of our subject matters. And we thought about how can you do that, and how would it work, and how would you fund it, and everything to do with that. And that's been over 4 or 5 years now that we were talking about that.
Mella, do you ride any of those bus lines regularly?
I ride all buses all over the system, but I lived in Four Corners and worked in Four Corners for 8 years, and I took that bus to work every day, the 23 bus that she just announced, and I also used 28 bus to get to places, go shopping and visit people and things like that.
Just ballpark, what would it mean for you to have those buses be free? What difference does it make daily for you?
First of all, speeding up the ride. If all doors open and everyone gets on, the bus moves faster. That improves air quality in our communities because the dwell time to get on, enter cash in, there's not a lot of access to Charlie cards in the communities that those buses serve. And because of that, we'll be able to move faster. There was a study done by Livable Streets Alliance that said that African-American people spend 64 more hours per year on buses than white folks do. And that's an amazing number. 64 hours, you get more time into your life, and you can do a lot with more time. And also, folks who have been, prosecuted and cited for fare evasion, you don't have to worry about that. You know, it's one less worry, and that is really amazing. And so there's less squabbles with the bus drivers about paying fares and things like that. It takes a lot of pressure and stress off of the riders. So when you get on there, hopefully it'll be even calmer on the bus because people are not, having to worry about such a thing.
I'm going to play a little sound for you, Mela. WBUR's Daryl C. Murphy spoke to a rider today named Rodney Gerald, who's been using the free 28 bus pilot. Here he is.
Yeah, it has been helpful for a lot of people around here because a lot of times you don't have enough change to get on a bus. You know, and the job is, working is hard right now, so it's helping a lot of people out in the city, and they run quick too, So, yeah, it's amazing. About time they try to do something for us.
What have you heard from riders who have participated in the 28 bus pilot? Do you think it's been successful? Is this model one that's going to work in expansion to the 23 and the 29?
Yes, I believe it's going to work. People are really happy that they don't have to try and dig for change. Like I said, there's not a lot of access to like Charlie cards, load your fares on. So the tap and go idea doesn't always work in our community. And so people don't have to worry about that. And like I said, it reduces stress. People in the pandemic, a lot of people lost their jobs or they had to go to work throughout the entire pandemic. They never stopped. They didn't work from home. And because of that, they really feel that the free bus pilot has been a godsend because a lot of people are going to look for jobs now and they need they need to be able to get around. And because of less money in their pockets, this is one less thing to have to concern yourselves with.
1-800-423-8255. Are you in favor of free bus in your city or town? Recognizing that the model here is that the city or town, in this case Boston, pays for those fares. So the city spends the money to pay for the fares on the free bus line. Would you like that in your community? 800-423-8255. Mela, please stay with us. I'm going to bring in an additional voice here. Brian Kane is the executive director of the MBTA Advisory Board. Brian, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
So I want to just start. I'm going to ask you the same question that was the first one I asked Mela. What is your reaction to Mayor Wu's announcement about, three free bus lines, her intention to do that?
I think Michelle Wu has the opportunity to be the most important politician for the MBTA since Mike Dukakis. You can tell by what she's done in just her first 2.5 days that she cares about the T and she cares about its future. And this is the sort of leadership that we need right now. Now, this with the free bus pilot, there are some concerns about sustainability in the long term, but I do give her a lot of credit for putting Boston's money where her mandate is and funding this with federal dollars.
So I want to underscore that. Funding it with federal dollars, essentially COVID relief dollars. This is a 2-year pilot. You've talked about your worry about sustainability. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So Boston this year in fiscal 22 will pay the MBTA $94 million in assessments. The mayor is on top
of
that.
So wait, just explain what an assessment is, please.
Oh, sure. So each city and town that receives MBTA service, there's 176 of them, pay the MBTA an assessment based on population. Boston, having the largest population in Massachusetts, pays the most at $94 million. And on top of that, the mayor is committing an additional $8 million. I think a good way to think of this $8 million is as if Boston is paying the fares for everyone that gets on the 28, the 23, and the 29 now.
So you're concerned that at the end of that 2 years, which is funded with federal money, what?
Yeah, so the T's budget is only balanced this year because of $665 million in one-time funds. What's going to happen in 2023, according to the Mass Taxpayers Foundation, is they're going to need about $1.25 billion every year for their capital and operating needs. My concern is that once these federal funds go away and the T's financial pressures get as great as we have seen them in the past, if not greater, there's going to be a lot of pressure to bring fares back to routes like this or cut services in order to make the T's budget whole. And if that's the case, we really haven't helped anybody in the long term.
So we are talking to Brian Kane, who is executive director of the MBTA Advisory Board, and Mella Bush Miles, director of Transit-Oriented Development and the T-Riders Union at Alternatives for Environment and Community. And we're talking about Boston Mayor Michelle Wu's move to make three bus lines free in Boston for 2 years. So, Mella, I'm going to turn back to you now. What's interesting about having you and Brian here is we're talking about this is how it affects my life, and then this is the policy and the money. And both things are real. Brian has raised a red flag about what happens at the end of those 2 years. What would happen if people had adjusted their lives to a free bus for 2 years, and then suddenly it's not free anymore?
Well, that was one of the questions that came up with the Lawrence pilot is, okay, what happens at the end of the 2 years? It goes away. Do you go back to what you were doing before? Well, we work with the MBTA. We work on issues around fair equity and issues for, with the MBTA, and how do we get to a place where we have an equitable, fair structure and an MBTA that works for all. And one of the things that concerns us is right now the MBTA has over $1 billion fare transformation project that they're doing to collect fares. There is a cost associated with collecting fares. You have to maintain the fare boxes, maintain the fare gates. You have to pay the security to count the money. And you go on and on and on, and there are costs connected to fares, just getting the fare. And then not a lot of that is actually going to actually pay help the T to continue to operate. It goes to debt. It goes to a lot of other things. So our belief has always been, if you remove that issue of the fares and all of the costs associated with the fares, you could actually operate a fare-free system and just count how many people get on and track all of these other things. So there's a way to do it, and that's what we need to sit down and really work out how to do it. And that $2 billion for a new fare system, that's a lot of money that's going in a direction that we don't see as sustainable either.
So the reporting
could have.
Sorry,
there were other ways to fix that without putting in a whole new fare system, fare collection system.
So just for listeners, the reporting that we have is it's a little more than $900 million for that new fare system. So, Brian, I'm going to turn back to you, and then I'll take a call. This is something that candidate Wu, before she was Mayor Wu, really did emphasize, that speeding things up and reducing the cost of collecting fares would be enough savings to help offset with, as a member of the MBTA Advisory Board. What's your response to that?
Oh, I've been paying attention to T finances for a long time. I worked in the budget department at the T for a while. Revenue from fares is about $680 million a year pre-COVID. And, this fare collection system costs $900 million. I think the math speaks for itself there in terms of how much it costs to collect fares. I think the more important thing that Mella said, which I completely agree with, is that we need to have a rethink about the way the MBTA is funded in Massachusetts. Now, the fact, I believe that fares are just too high right now, but I also believe that the MBTA is just following through on a mandate that they received from the legislature in 2015 to increase own source revenue. So they've done what they were told to do, and now we need to go back and rethink how they're completely structured financially. Without that, Ms. Bush is absolutely right. We're going to keep having to pay this enormous debt. We're going to keep having to pay for these enormous legacy costs, and we are going to be in big trouble starting in 2023.
All right, I'm going to pick up one call. We've got Evelyn on the line in Milton. Evelyn, briefly, go ahead.
Yes, I just was concerned about how the fares are going to be paid for. I mean, I worked in Boston. I rode the bus, the train for 30 years, and I always had to pay. Even time that it was tough paying. So typically these kind of freebies get passed along to the paying customers, and that seems unfair. I'm just wondering about down the road, that's what's going to happen in my view.
Mella, I'd like to give you a chance to respond to Evelyn's concern there.
So everyone pays for the tea already. We all pay for it through our taxes, through sales taxes. When Governor Patrick was in office, who just was on the call on the radio with us previously, He actually raised the sales tax from 5% to 6.25%, and part of that went to the MBTA to pay for that. You know, and there's a number of other ways that we're all paying for the MBTA already. So it's not just fares. And if it was only fares, that's an unsustainable way, because the people who pay the most fares are the people who are benefiting from this free fare pilot. They paid higher fares in the past to ride. And so that's not a sustainable way to run an MBTA. So not to worry about that, because you're already paying for it. We pay for it with our taxes and a number of other allocated funding streams for the MBTA that come out of our pockets already, out of everyone's pockets. It's part of public transportation, which is a public good.
And Brian Kane, back to you for just a moment. Is there a path with political will in place? Is there a path where cities and towns could make their buses free in a sustainable way, briefly?
There is a path. It will require a lot of hard work, a lot of collaboration, and more money from the state. Yes, it can be done if we choose to do it.
And what would we likely give up?
Money. This is going to be expensive. There is no such thing as a free ride. And eventually, in this game of musical chairs, the music will stop, the federal money will run out, and someone's going to have to pay the bill. And that will be the taxpayers. The question is just, how much will it be, and in what form?
Well, I have appreciated both of you in this conversation. Brian Kane, Executive Director of the MBTA Advisory Board, thank you.
Thank you, Tiziana.
And Mella Bush-Miles, Director of Transit-Oriented Development and the T-Riders Union at Alternatives for Environment and Community. Mella, always great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Have a great day. Be well.
Memes, they are everywhere. It's those pictures on social media, sometimes with words, sometimes without, that people use and reuse to convey some message or feeling. Now, yesterday, we heard about the origins of the meme before memes. Kilroy was here. Today, we're going to dive into what has to be the most local meme of all time. Just ask Scumbag Steve, a.k.a. Blake Boston of Millis, Massachusetts. And I want to be clear, that is not me being judgy. That is the official name of the meme, which went viral 10 years ago after a stranger pulled a picture his mother took of him from his MySpace. His face has been paired with phrases like, makes fun of your job, unemployed, is watching Star Wars, roots for the Empire, makes waitress list all beers on tap, orders a Bud Light. But as Ben Brock Johnson and Amory Sievertson from WBUR's Endless Thread podcast found out, there is more to Blake Boston than his baggy jeans and backward hat. Ben and Amory spoke with Blake and his mom for an episode of this season's Endless Thread podcast dedicated to memes. We're going to bring Amory and Ben in a minute, but first, let's hear some of that episode. You will hear Ben first asking Blake and his mom about Mother's Day.
Is it true that for previous Mother's Days, you used to ask Blake to
steal
some flowers?
Yes,
is that true?
Yes, it is, and I find that, you know, it's nature. I mean, okay, it is in somebody's yard, but, you know,
oh
you would
God.
Think.
It was like drive-by. She literally drive me around. So we lived in Medfield at the time. So we would literally drive around, what do you call this, Norfolk County, I guess you'd call it.
Yeah.
And there would be like 5-6 different towns. And then by the time we were done, she'd have a bouquet of all different colored lilacs. It would literally, probably if you bought it at the store, it'd be like a $300 bouquet because it was so large. I bought her flowers one time. I bought her lilacs.
And I was mad I
she
gave
threw
them a silent
them
treatment. I was like, this is something, this is a tradition that we need to do all the time.
Oh,
but he would get some one guy chased us and he's like, Mom, floor it. And I was like, I would be the driver.
Yeah, that was the year I was on probation and you made me do it. I was like, Mom, you're going to get me arrested.
Oh, all the time.
This
oh
is,
my God.
So I feel like you're already answering this question, but like, how would you describe your relationship to each other?
I don't really like him.
I don't even remember her name.
This couldn't be further from the truth. Blake and Susan finish each other's stories, each other's sentences, each other's jokes. You couldn't find two peas more in a pod.
But a lot of close parent-child relationships are forged in the fires of trauma. And if you're lucky, the love and humor and struggle that can come after that trauma. So it also makes sense, because Blake Boston and his mom have some trauma. Some of it unrelated to the meme, some of it very related to the meme.
Like, sticks and stones break your bones, but words will never hurt you.
But they do. Hi, I'm Susan Boston, and I live in Millis, Dogtown. All right, that's awful because somebody will listen to it.
I never heard that term.
Okay. Someone's like, there's that freaking Sue Boston over there talking trash. Then you're going to call me in hysterics. Get down here, please.
No, I'm Susan Boston, and I live in Massachusetts. No. And I'm a mom and a grandmother and a wife. How about you, Blake, now that you can speak?
Well, Cynthia asked. My name is Blake Boston, a.k.a. Scumbag Steve, and I am a loving father, cook by profession slash musician, and I'm just, you know, doing my thing, raising my kids, having a good time while doing it, you know?
Don't forget your fiancé.
Oh, my God.
That would have been a complete...
Take two.
You just heard an excerpt from episode 2 of the new season of WBUR's Endless Thread. We caught up with co-hosts Anne-Marie Sievertson and Ben Brock Johnson and asked them about the relationship between Blake and his mom.
Oh, that interaction really captures it all. I mean, I am truly in awe of this mother and son who... I think the heart of their relationship, Tiziana, is that they don't keep anything from each other. They just have this level of honesty, and there's a transparency there that I think is truly rare between any parent and child. And that leads to interactions like the one you just heard, which are unexpected and surprising and refreshing all at the same time.
They just clearly love each other so much. And I think that some of that rapport, some of that realness and honesty, I do believe came from the experience that they went through when Blake became this truly ubiquitous. I mean, I think, you know, we came across a couple of suggestions saying that there were as many as 10 million, 5 million to 10 million versions of this meme online that really paint Blake Boston as a terrible person, right? Like, and it's all in jest, but can you imagine a world in which your mom takes a picture of you, a silly sort of candid picture, and puts it up on your MySpace page in order to try to help you promote your music, which is what he was doing at the time. And that becomes the origin of the entire internet laughing at you effectively for years and years and years. And I think that that really threw them for a loop, as it would anyone. And, you know, we talk in the episode about the various parts of their life that this impacted. You know, Blake, at the time that the meme was really ubiquitous, he was in a custody battle, and the meme sort of threatened the outcome of that and him getting custody of his two sons, just the way that it impacted both of them in dealing with the trauma and his mom and him sort of trying to defend themselves at a certain point from the internet trolls. And of course, you know, as we all know, there's no winning that battle, right? So yeah, in some ways, you know, Blake's mom, Susan, really feels responsible doubly, right? Responsible as his mother, but also responsible as the person who effectively created the meme.
So Amory, there is a cruelty here. From the term scumbag, Steve, which just, I gotta admit, I think I've just said that word in this segment more times than I've said it in my entire life. It's a terrible word, right?
Yeah, and it cuts.
Yes.
I hear ya.
And then the characteristics, the traits that people ascribed to him. Talk a little bit about that. First, maybe illustrate a few more of those lines. And then the collective cruelty that people felt free to lay onto someone else's identity.
In captioning the photo, and even in calling it Scumbag Steve, they're labeling this person as a terrible person. And I actually see it differently. I think it is so specific in a way that hurts a little bit more than saying he's a terrible person. Because if you say someone's a terrible person, you think they have done something truly horrific. They've committed some horrible, horrific crime. And the specificity of the Scumbag Steve captions, things like asks the server to name every craft beer on tap and then orders a Bud Light, that feels more specific. You're not saying this person is a horrible human being. You're saying that they are
kind of worthless.
Yeah, kind of, you know, not worthy of that much respect, or they're finding it inconveniencing people, or they're a little dishonest. to me, like, the cruelty of it is in the specificity that people were able to identify scumbag-ish behaviors that felt so real to the point that, you know, Blake himself was wondering, I mean, I've maybe done some of these things, but I'm not a bad person. I'm just a human being who has, you know, made some mistakes. And maybe one time I did drink a little too much and did something ridiculous. So I think to me, that's kind of at the core of it, is that the more specific you get with memes, honestly, the further they spread, because you tap into something that feels custom made for you. And also the more it can potentially hurt, because for even for Blake, the line got a little blurry and he wasn't sure if he should lean into the scumbag identity or really try to shy away from it and say, no, 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 that's not me. And in the meantime, lines were crossed in the process where, you know, Blake would see captions that had to do with disrespecting women or taking advantage of women. And that was a line that he really wanted to draw and say, no, I would never do that. Like, maybe I've borrowed someone's lighter and forgotten to give it back or just didn't give it back, but I would never do that specific thing that you said.
So, you also see him kind of struggle with, like, fully taking on the mantle. Like, right after the meme blew up, he really leaned into it, right? Like, he sort of leaned into the character. He made a rap song. He went and went to conventions and appeared at conventions and really tried to kind of lean into the character. But over time, you can also see that the toll that that took on his life and his mom's life, and also, like, just his identity, like, his own, the own, like, confusion about his own identity.
It does seem like if you lean into letting someone else define you, that eventually you might lose yourself.
Absolutely.
So let's stay with this defining idea, because the other thing that struck me, and of course you can't make up the irony of the fact that his name is actually Blake Boston. and it does feel like some of this was sort of the collective glee of hating on what people think is a stereotype of the white guy from Boston. Am I projecting there, or is that legit?
No. No, I think that's absolutely true. He becomes this avatar for a particular kind of Boston or Massachusetts area person, right? And especially Boston dudes, I think, you know, he really becomes this avatar for that stereotype. It's really interesting how in some ways it feels on point in terms of who he is, or at least his demeanor, but, like, it's also so not who he is.
Yeah, especially because the core of Scumbag Steve is a disregard for others. And that's not Blake. And it is really obvious once you actually spend time around him that, wow, how unfair that you were labeled someone who has a total disregard for others.
You know, the two of you have talked a number of times about the love between he and his mom, just the love, the respect, the openness, the honesty, the transparency. And I guess I find myself thinking, okay, so are there any memes out there that really come from a place of love? Is that even possible? Are there loving memes?
So this is a great question. And I think that, so one of the episodes that we did, spoiler, hopefully not too many spoilers here, but one of the episodes that we did in our series was about the Rickroll. You know, if you don't know what the Rickroll is, I hope you find out soon, but it's...
You're about to get Rickrolled in 3, 2, 1.
Never gonna give you up, never gonna let you down.
So, Rick Astley, baby!
So it's when Rick Astley gets played. You think that you're gonna click on a link and go somewhere and get some pertinent information. Instead, you get the you know, Rick Astley singing to you via the music video for "Never Gonna Give You Up." But that one, to us, even though it's a prank, I think we ended up feeling, and all the folks that we talked to for that particular episode, ended up feeling like at the end of the day, it was a really positive vibes meme. Like, even if you're getting pranked, it's kind of fun and hilarious. And it's a song that just, you know, kind of makes you want to dance and laugh. And so I think that would be my answer. I don't know about Amory, but that one feels pretty positive to me.
I would definitely say we could use more positive love fueled memes. One that comes to mind for me is the "You're doing amazing, sweetie," which I don't even remember the origin. I mean, that's when you know something has truly taken on a mimetic identity, is that I literally do not remember the origin of that phrase. But when people started assigning that to various things to kind of just say, like, it's fine, it's going to be fine. You know, like, you're doing amazing, sweetie, even if you're not, or well, even if you don't feel like you are.
The second you said it, I was like, oh, thank you. Yeah, even though you weren't actually even talking to me.
I think this is a good challenge. I take it as a challenge, Tiziana, at least, that you've put on the table, is that, like, can we make more positive things go viral? Like Bernie mittens, right? I mean, that's,
yes,
that is something that he was superimposed in all of these kind of lovely or clever or creative ways. And we need more that has a little more purity of spirit, I think, in memes, because it's possible.
All right. Are you ready for the last hard question for both of you?
Yeah.
Bring it on.
What is something you learned about humanity that kind of rocked your world a little bit from studying all these memes? Ben?
I think that in looking at this series, something that I've understood, or something that blew my mind a little bit about humanity, is just the kind of layered nature of communication and how memes specifically, just how rich they can be when it comes to communicating not just one idea, but like multiple ideas. It can really deliver a lot of information. And we've looked at examples of this in places where there is actually a lot of political strife. You know, in one of our episodes, we look at a meme that became really popular in Kenya. Mm-hmm. And in Kenya, people are like being hauled into court for memeing, because they're sort of questioning the government and how the government interacts with the IMF.
The International Monetary Fund.
Yeah. And so, like, there's a really interesting aspect to it, too, where memes can actually be really powerful in questioning authority.
The core of memes is, and why they succeed, is that people want to connect with each other. People want to relate to each other. And especially during a pandemic, when we can't connect with each other face to face as much as we would like to, the fact that someone on the other side of the globe can share a joke that I might find funny because it says something fundamentally about us as human beings, or about art that we both like, that's really powerful. And that should not be downplayed or overlooked, that memes are this simpler way for two people who have never met each other and never will meet each other to connect over a shared interest or feeling or cultural reference.
That was Amory Sievertson and Ben Brock Johnson, co-hosts of WBUR's podcast Endless Thread. You can listen to the full episodes from this season at WBUR.org, or you can download in podcast form wherever you get your podcasts. That's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Thanks for listening. I'm Tiziana Deering. Tune in tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.